Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
This is Andrew Peach in London. Welcome to News Hour from the BBC World Service. 6 days until the US election. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump have been campaigning in North Carolina and Pennsylvania. They're both in the swing state of Wisconsin as well today. We're going to be live there with News Hour's James Kumarasamy in about half an hour's time. First, the Israeli military has launched a series of airstrikes on Hezbollah targets in the eastern Lebanese city of Baalbek and its surrounding villages. One of the explosions was caught live on Al Jazeera TV in Lebanon. The city's mayor said more than 50,000 people fled within hours of being told the strikes were going to happen. Roads were jammed with panicking residents trying to escape. Baalbek, which is a Hezbollah stronghold, is also home to some of the region's best preserved Roman temples. It is a UNESCO World Heritage Site. Our correspondent Hugo Bashega is in Beirut. I asked Hugo why it's the first time Baalbek has been hit.
This is a city that had been relatively untouched by Israeli airstrikes in this war. And I think a lot of people will be familiar with Baalbek because this is a city very popular with tourists, famous for its Roman ruins. And I think what is important here is that this could suggest that the Israeli military is expanding its campaign against Hezbollah in the east of the country. We've seen that the south has been heavily hit. Beirut's southern suburbs also, you know, have been a target of the Israeli military. But I think we could be seeing now an intensification of this air campaign against Hezbollah in the east, because this is another area where Hezbollah has a very strong presence. And this is a part of the country where Hezbollah has built part of its infrastructure. It recruits fighters in those areas. And this is also strategically important because it's near the border with Syria. And, you know, it is part of a route connecting Hezbollah with its allies in Syria, Iraq, and also Iran, which is obviously Hezbollah's main supporter.
We had this message from the new leader of Hezbollah from a secret location today. Tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah, so this was the first speech from Naim Qassem after he was announced as the new Hezbollah Secretary General, replacing Hassan Nasrallah, who was killed in an Israeli airstrike here in Beirut. He spoke for more than an hour. I think, unsurprisingly, he didn't announce any change in terms of Hezbollah's strategy. He said that the war was going to continue. But I think it was very interesting that he said Hezbollah could accept a ceasefire with Israel if the conditions were right. And I think this is very important because in the last few days, there's been a lot of speculation about the possibility of a ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah. The Americans tonight are confirming that two senior officials are going to Israel tomorrow to discuss a deal. And it seems that this plan being discussed includes a 60-day ceasefire. And during this pause in hostilities, all sides would discuss the full implementation of the United Nations resolution that ended the last war here in 2006. So it seems that there's a lot of discussion happening behind the scenes, and we could see a ceasefire, perhaps not in the next few days, in the next few weeks, but we could see a ceasefire in this conflict.
Our correspondent Hugo Bashega in Beirut. Let's find out a bit more about what's happening in Baalbek. I've been talking to the MP Antoine Habchi of the Strong Republic Party, who represents part of the city.
There are a lot of displaced people that they are seeking shelters. So the situation up there is really catastrophic. I'm talking about Deir al-Ahmar, for example. This region was already saturated because till yesterday, we had almost 10 to 12,000 displaced people. Today, mainly after the Israeli warnings to Baalbek city and other surrounding villages, families were evacuating since noon towards different regions, but mainly towards the region of Deir al-Ahmar. When I say families, I'm talking about thousands of people. In Baalbek, the striked region now, there was at least 15,000 displaced persons. So they are, for the second time, they are seeking shelter. And hundreds of our other families also are seeking to leave Baalbek towards other region.
And some people, of course, will have family members or friends to go and stay with. For people who don't have that, where are they going?
Oh, it's a problematic. There is no possibility anymore. I've already said, since the region of Deir al-Ahmar has reached its full capacity and is not capable anymore of providing the right support, it's to mention that the government should direct the displaced people to new shelters. And these new shelters should be really established in order to receive them. All the schools are saturated with displaced people and with families. Even they are received in private houses and they are received in churches. The main issues to ensure water, food for these people. We need mattresses. Everything in this meaning is needed.
We've heard a lot about Baalbek in the news in recent days, but most people listening to NewsHour won't have been there.
It's maybe the second or the third biggest and conserved ruins of the Roman Empire. You have different temples, the temple for Bacchus and the ruins of a whole citadel. And it's very well conserved. It used to be the main cultural event was held at Baalbek ruins. And it used to be a really touristic site that is attractive, not only from Lebanon, from all around the world. It used to be a main site, economic site. Since 2-3 years, it's not anymore the same. We know definitely why, because Hezbollah was around, and you can understand why people, they weren't secure to visit these ruins. And today the risk is bigger. Some of these streets around Baalbek ruins, they date since 1,000 years. It's an international heritage and it should be protected by the international community. And Israel shouldn't be able to strike around the ruins of Baalbek al-Hirmel or Baalbek al-Hirmel citadel as is.
That's the Baalbek MP Antoine Habchi of the Strong Republic Party. News just breaking on the Reuters news agency that Israeli strikes have killed 19 people, including 8 women, in 2 towns near Baalbek. This is according to the Lebanese Health Ministry. Now, China has declared a complete success after launching a new 3-person crew to its homegrown space station. It's seeking to explore outer space with missions to the moon and beyond. Beijing making no secret of the fact it wants to get someone to the moon by 2030. Washington is growing pretty alarmed about all this, with the head of NASA declaring a new space race. Our China correspondent Laura Bicker has been granted rare access to the launch base.
I'm standing at the edge of the Gobi Desert waiting for the launch of Shenzhou 19. This is China's latest mission to its homegrown space station called Tiangong, or Heavenly Palace. The BBC has been given rare access to this launch centre, and I'm just about a kilometre away from the spacecraft itself. So we're expecting one almighty roar. This launch is yet another step in a growing space race, a battle which could eventually decide who owns the moon.
The three chosen to fly to China's homegrown space station were introduced from behind glass to prevent infection. They include the country's first female space engineer, Wang Haozi.
I dream of exploring the vastness of space, waving to the stars, and of course, looking back at my homeland. My deepest affection will always be for my motherland, no matter where I am. I will keep striving and working tirelessly.
The team have trained together for a year to conduct experiments and carry out spacewalks. The pilot is a veteran, but both Wang and her crewmate are China's next generation of space explorers. And this year they watched their country carry out an historic first and collect lunar samples from the far side of the moon. China also has a fleet of satellites in space and has plans for many more, a rival to Elon Musk's Starlink. After meeting the astronauts, we were allowed right next to the spacecraft several hours before launch. You can hear the announcements in the background. Final preparations are being made. President Xi has described China's space ambitions as the eternal dream. But every year, that dream gets a little closer. This country is making technological advances with every mission to space. And it has Washington worried. The head of NASA has said that the US and China is in a new space race. Li Yinyang from China's manned spaceflight agency told us the country's discoveries belonged to the world.
I think his concerns are unnecessary. We adhere to the principles of peaceful use, equality, mutual benefit, and joint development.
Hundreds have gathered along the streets in the dark to wave flags and brightly coloured lights as the taikonauts make their last few steps on Earth before heading to the launch site. The brass band strikes up Ode to the Motherland as young children kept up late for the occasion. Their cheeks adorned with the Chinese flag shout every note. This is a moment of national pride. China's rivalry with the US is no longer just based here on Earth. Both could soon be staking territorial claims well beyond this planet.
That's our China correspondent Laura Bicker reporting from the Gobi Desert. You can read more about that story online at bbc.com/news. The article's called China Declares Success as Its Youngest Astronauts Reach Space. Also, we've got the latest from Spain with the 100 people killed there in flash flooding, and of course, much more from the US election campaign as well. Our web address, bbc.com/news. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. And coming up...
Listen, I'm going to float like a butterfly and sing like a bee. George can't hit what his eyes can't see. Now you see me, now you don't. You think you will, but I know you won't.
The voice of Muhammad Ali, the surprise winner of the Rumble in the Jungle 50 years ago today. I'm going to be talking to his opponent, George Foreman, later. Other stories we're looking at, Kamala Harris has vowed to serve all Americans as she seeks to contain the fallout after President Biden appeared to refer to Donald Trump supporters as garbage. And the Houthis in Yemen have for the first time indicated they could be willing to sign a UN roadmap for peace if Saudi Arabia was serious about ending the conflict. Updates on all of those stories here on the BBC World Service and at bbc.com/news. You're listening to NewsHour with Andrew Peach. live from London. It's NewsHour here on the BBC. The video footage you might have seen on your phone shows overturned cars and smashed shop fronts. Spain has now declared 3 days of mourning after around 100 people died in the flash floods, mainly in Valencia. More than 1,000 military personnel have been deployed to the east and south. The Spanish Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, says those who've suffered won't be abandoned. The mayor of Orno de Acedo, Consolano Tarazone, told NewsHour what it looks like there.
Una visión dantesca.
It was a terrible vision. In my 58 years, I've never seen anything like this before. Generally, the water comes from the lower parts to the higher parts of the town. But in this case, because water has been coming from other towns in Valencia, it has been running through other villages and it first flooded the higher part of our town.
Now, the sort of flooding we've seen in Spain is linked to incidents of extreme drought that we've seen more of as well. Drought has affected half of the land surface of the earth in the last year, according to new figures out today from the Lancet Countdown to Health and Climate Change. Droughts and flooding are two sides of the same coin. The new BBC World Service series Life at 50 Degrees looks at the impact of climate change on water. Our population correspondent Stephanie Hegarty has been telling me more about this link between flooding and drought.
So what we know about the effect of climate change is as the earth warms up, the oceans warm up, and that means they evaporate more into the air. At the same time, the air warms up and it can absorb more moisture. For every degree of warming, the air can absorb 7% more moisture. We know the planet's already warmed 1.2 degrees over pre-industrial levels. So we've got a lot more moisture in the air. When that hits land or forms into storms, it causes more intense storms or it causes more intense bouts of rain. And after that, then you get periods of drought. On the flip side, if you have a long period of drought and then that's followed by rain, which is happening increasingly, we saw in Spain really serious droughts last year and the beginning of this year over the summer, then you get the soil drying out, it becomes hard, and when the rain hits it, it runs off faster, and that creates flash flooding.
That's interesting. So it's the same water, basically, but distributed in a more uneven way, and then exacerbated by the ground conditions.
This is exactly what climate change is doing. It's changing the way our weather patterns work. And these new patterns we're not used to, our infrastructure isn't used to it, and the land and the soil aren't used to it. Plants aren't used to it. Plants can adapt to drought conditions, and then when the rain comes, they're just completely unprepared for it.
And countries like Spain will need to think about their infrastructure in the context of having to cope with both of these things, with drought and floods. Tell me about how the changes we're seeing are affecting people who live in droughted areas.
This data that has come out today has shown that in the 1980s, 15% of the world's landmass was affected by extreme drought. And now that figure is around 45%. So it's tripled in 40 years. So as part of this Life at 50 Degrees series, the World Service travelled to parts of the world that are hottest, that are experiencing the most intense increase in temperatures, but also are struggling from a lack of water. So we went to northeastern Syria, a town called Hakusa, and there, a million inhabitants of the city have been almost completely cut off from their water supply. They used to get water through their river, which over the past 20 years or so has completely dried up. Now all the water they need comes in from other places in tankers. This is a resident of Hasaka that we met at one of these points of water distribution.
For the rest of the people, there's no access to water. It's unfair for the poor people to die of thirst. People are going to go thirsty all day. There's no water in this neighbourhood whatsoever. On this street, we fight over one container of water. It's okay for children to fight, but we also fight over water. People are ready to kill their neighbour over water. May God help you.
Now, for this series, your team also went to South Sudan and found a very different dynamic there. Explain more to me.
So what's happening in South Sudan is this double hazard where they faced... half of the country was in extreme drought last year, and then 700,000 people were affected by flooding. So we have this situation where the soil is dry and damaged, lacking in plant cover, and then flooding hits and it really just washes everything away. We spoke to families there who have lost everything, their farms, their cattle herders. They're traditionally a cattle herding community, and they are now forced to live in displacement camps to rely on government aid. And when that's not enough, they have to forage in the floodwater for food to eat. When we met them, they were foraging for water lily roots.
This is it. Eating this is like eating mud. You need to add something like fish to be able to eat it. In the past, things were nothing like this. Children were playing around and we held traditional dances and other gatherings everywhere. That was daily life. But when the floods arrived, people started to leave for elsewhere. For those of us who stayed behind, this is how we survive.
So the impacts of this are huge on agriculture, also on in terms of the health impacts too. These are quite dramatic changes that our planet's facing. And if they continue, if we continue to emit greenhouse gases, we may get to a situation where we're just not equipped to handle them.
That was our population correspondent, Stephanie Hegarty. The new series is called Life at 50 Degrees. Now, what do elephants, spider monkeys, cedar waxwing birds and even fruit flies have in common? Well, the scientific evidence that they are some of the animals that are found to consume alcohol or ethanol in the natural world. A team at the University of Exeter in the UK has been documenting this trend. Lead author Anna Boland has been talking to my NewsHour colleague Celia Hatton.
We wanted to collate all this knowledge and the data that's out there to look at ethanol use outside of what we know how humans use ethanol, which is quite widely discussed. And there's some really great examples out there. So tree shrews, for example, have been found to feed a lot on fermented nectar of the Burton palm. We have evidence that wild chimpanzees ingest fermented raffia palm sap.
Do we understand why animals might want to indulge in ethanol or alcohol? Is there evidence that animals are actually wanting the alcohol, the effects of alcohol, or do they just overindulge in sugary substances containing alcohol or ethanol?
That's a good question. And there's a few hypotheses out there as to why animals might be feeding on these fermented food sources. Whether they're targeting the ethanol specifically or not, we still don't have much data on. So we don't know if they're showing a preference for these things. It could just be that, for example, sugary foods such as fruit, nectars and saps, when they're infected by yeast, ferment. And since animals might feed on these food sources, they'll just automatically ingest ethanol as part of the diet, whether they're sourcing it for the ethanol or not. Other hypotheses that have been put forward is that ethanol has been found to have some medicinal benefits. Also, it could be nutritional for energy-seeking purposes. Even potentially, although again, not very tested, particularly in the wild or nature, are the cognitive influences of ethanol. It's very unlikely that animals will be chasing intoxication. As you know, when you're drunk, injuries are more likely. And if you're an animal, predation becomes more likely, and it would greatly decrease your survival probability.
And what about the example of male fruit flies, though? Didn't you find some evidence that they indulge in ethanol more often under certain circumstances? Can you explain?
Yeah, so there's a pretty cool study that looks at when male flies are ejected by a mate, they tend to increase their intake in alcohol, which I'm sure maybe don't know many humans can relate to. And then with the opposite, female flies, it reduces their choosiness of mates. So there's quite some interesting behavioral implications that alcohol could have on some species. Again, still know quite little about the behavioral implications in a wild context.
We have more in common with fruit flies than any of us realise. That was Anna Boland from the University of Exeter in the UK talking to NewsHour.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. Presenting the first budget by a Labour Party government in the UK for 14 years, The Chancellor of the Exchequer says she'll raise taxes by $50 billion. Rachel Reeves, the UK's first ever female finance minister, said the British government would invest in green industries and provide more than $30 billion in extra funding for the National Health Service. The Greek economist Vicky Price is from the Centre for Economics and Business Research, and she told me more about today's budget.
We've had a very substantial tax rise, which has fallen mainly on businesses. The tax increases are about $40 billion. They're starting almost immediately. There is an increase in the national insurance contributions for employers. And what has really happened is that the government, which found there was a black hole, which needed to be filled in somehow, which they inherited from the Conservatives, who were running the previous government, had boxed themselves in not being able, because of manifesto commitments, to raise income tax or any other taxes which working people pay who are employed, and they had to raise that money from businesses. And that's a real, real issue about what growth we might see in the future as a result.
The Chancellor of Finance Minister Rachel Reeves was very keen to point out at every turn that despite this extra £40 billion or $50 billion of tax that she wants to raise, the UK economy would still remain competitive among G7 countries. Is that right?
Depends what we mean about competitive. If she means that we're going to still be growing, yes, perhaps we're growing faster than Germany at present. But the forecasts for growth over the next few years have hardly changed. Only a little bit up for next year by the Independent Office for Budget Responsibility that produces a forecast alongside the budget. And that suggests that all the extra spending which the government wants to do and the extra borrowing that is going to be involved, which is actually quite significant, substantially something like $36 billion extra per year over the next 5 years, is going to be going mainly to improve public services, a little bit on investment, but will have very little impact on the growth profile of the UK.
Can you do both things? There's an expectation from the UK public that money would be invested in public services, and we've seen some of that. But the government's also said that growth is its main priority.
Yes, well, if we believe the forecasts that have come out, they will get growth, but the growth is going to be mainly because interest rates are coming down and inflation is likely to stay low. And that, of course, boosts people's confidence, and also businesses will be finding some of their costs are not increased as much as they were increasing over the last couple of years. So that will happen, but not really because of the measures that have been announced. In fact, if anything, in the short term, we'll see less growth because of those measures than would otherwise be the case. And the question is whether in the longer term, some of the investment that's going to take place and some of the improvement in public services, which we've got to admit, if you get better public services, better health services, then you have better outcomes for the population as a whole. So you could, in fact, get some improvement over that. But even the forecast that we've seen now suggests that those improvements are going to only really materialise in the very long term. And, of course, very little was said about Europe, even though there was something about perhaps getting closer to Europe in the early part of the speech by our new Chancellor.
That's Vicky Price, who's the Chief Economic Advisor at the Centre for Economics and Business in London. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is Andrew Peach in London with NewsHour in Wisconsin for us. Here's James Kumarasamy.
Thanks, Andrew, and welcome to Madison, capital of one of the swing states, the ones where the outcome is uncertain, that will decide next Tuesday's US presidential election. This Midwestern state, won by Donald Trump in 2016, then by Joe Biden in 2020, by the same tight margin of 0.7%, is as swingy as it gets. And it's not just NewsHour focusing its attention here. Both major party nominees have campaign events in the state today. Republican Donald Trump is in Green Bay, a couple of hours north of here, while Kamala Harris is coming to this city, Democratic Blue Madison. There are also congressional races in this dairy farming state on the same butter knife's edge as the one for the White House. To get a feel for the political mood ahead of this consequential election, I've been back to part of rural southwestern Wisconsin I visited before for NewsHour, a county that comfortably backed Barack Obama before swinging behind Donald Trump.
Yeah, they probably think I should be dumping them some buckets of corn pretty soon.
In the rolling hills of southwestern Wisconsin, farmer Rob Kinch surveys his 50 purebred Angus cows and sings the praises of his two guard donkeys.
They're supposed to be good to keep the coyotes away. I've seen videos of a donkey just tear the hell out of a mountain lion. It's quite an interesting video.
We didn't get to see the video, but we did hear Trump supporting Rob's assessment of the economic challenges facing America's beef, corn and dairy farmers, as well as his radical remedy.
Inflation hurts you on all the commodities. You can't afford to have somebody fix anything for you. They want $100, $150 an hour. So I think we're so far in debt from the federal government and printed so much money in the last 4 years from COVID.
So is there anything a new government could do?
My personal plan, if I was president of the United States right now, I would fire 50% of the federal employees. We don't need them all fussing over every little thing we do. That would cut the budget immensely. And when they figured out how to get by with half the employees they got now, I'd fire another half.
We've just left Rob's farm and we're heading to Platteville. It's the largest town in Grant County. It's got just over 11,000 inhabitants and is best known for its university, UW-Platteville. In the past, though, it was most famous for its lead and zinc mines. They are now all closed, but immortalised in a giant letter M on a hillside that overlooks the town, said to be the largest letter M in the world. I'm going to catch up with someone I last met when I was in Platteville 6 years ago.
The city of Platteville is very Democratic, but the surrounding area is very Republican. This area is kind of a blueberry in a bowl of red jello.
The man with the food-based description of the county's political dynamics is Steve Prestegard, editor of the local newspaper, the Platteville Journal. Republican Red has certainly been on a roll in this part of southwest Wisconsin. Donald Trump increased his share of the vote in Grant County in 2020, even as Joe Biden narrowly won the state. I asked Steve whether anything had changed politically in the past few years.
Well, there's a lot that hasn't changed, but I think it's gotten more intense. Politics drives people crazy. Some of the people that I know basically are incapable of having a political conversation. And you'd kind of wonder how this is all going to work out after November 5th.
Wandering around, a lot that's familiar, but one thing I noticed immediately is different is the Democratic and the Republican Party have their headquarters almost opposite each other now. That wasn't here before. How is that going?
Well, I think they haven't had any issue. There's kind of a demilitarized zone of the pizza place and the hotel and library between the two of them.
Well, this is what Steve calls Platteville's demilitarized zone. Just in front of me is the Republican Party of Grant County's office. The sign says, for a strong economy, vote Trump. And just down the road past Steve's Pizza Palace, which since I was last here has added a new dairy delight to the menu, a mac and cheese pizza. There is a big Harris and Waltz sign and the Democratic Party of Grant County's headquarters.
Welcome.
Thank you. Hi, Jamie Kumarasamy from the BBC. Nice to meet you, Jamie.
Nice. I'm Joyce Boss. I'm the chair of the Grant County Democrats, and I'm really happy to have you come this morning. I don't think it's our job to persuade the people. I think it's our job to get out as many people to vote as possible. And we believe that the people that think the Democratic way far outnumber the people that think the Republican way. So if we can make them feel assured that their vote counts in getting them out to vote, I think we're going to see a landslide. Here in Wisconsin, we call a landslide 1%.
What a nice warm applause coming out on a Monday night. Folks, we've got 8 days to go.
The presidential race isn't this year's only close contest in Wisconsin. In a Platteville bar, the Republican candidate for the U.S. Senate, businessman Eric Hovde, addresses a Trump-loving crowd. His message takes in familiar themes of open borders and trans ideology, but the messenger is slick and the language respectful, and he gets the loudest applause when he talks about unity.
You know, we're living in our echo chambers, we're putting on the red jersey or blue jersey, fighting amongst ourselves. We got to put on the red, white, and blue jersey and come together, get things done and fixed.
After the event, he told me how he planned to achieve that.
First of all, you start lowering the rhetoric, and then you start reaching across the aisle. When I get to Washington, D.C., I'm going to go meet every Democratic senator. In the world of business, if you're not willing to compromise, you're never going to get anything done. But in the world of politics, our current politics, there's no compromise, and they're throwing bombs at each other. And I think we got to move past that.
To talk more about my platform. I grew up on a dairy farm up in Eau Claire.
On the same evening, across town at the university, a Democratic candidate for Congress is emphasizing her farming roots as she tries to woo first-time voters. I spoke to two of them, a young female student firmly in the Harris camp and her less convinced male friend.
Hi, my name is Allie. I'm a sophomore here at UW-Platteville.
And my name is Jackson, and I am also a sophomore studying chemistry.
I'm really passionate about politics, and I would say that definitely access to reproductive health care is a big concern for me. I will share, I am a victim of sexual assault, and, you know, luckily nothing ever came of it, but heaven forbid I was pregnant as a result of it, I would absolutely want access to health care, yeah.
So I guess I can guess which way you'll be voting, can I?
You sure can.
Right, well, let's bring in the man.
Yeah, come on, Jess.
Women's rights, is that important to you?
Women's rights is very important to me. The reason I'm here is just to become more informed. So,
and have you made up your mind? How are you going to vote?
I have not made up my mind.
You are this absolute key demographic, the undecided voter in a swing state where the margins are tiny. What are you waiting to hear?
Some of the topics I do care very much for is like border security, our economy.
So Jackson's undecided. Are you trying to convince him?
I don't think there's a lot of convincing to be done. I think it's a lot of reconsidering the relationships you have with women in your life. And we are some of the closest women to Jackson. I think it's just showing up for the women in your life.
Jackson, you got your arms folded, which, you know, body language experts might say is... Not a great look at this point. There we go. In your pockets now. Go on. Yep. So how do you react to that?
That will be a consideration, but I also don't want it to affect me greatly about just because everybody I know is going one way doesn't mean I'm going to follow. I'd like to think for myself and reach my own decision without a lot of influence from others.
That's Jackson, a student in southwestern Wisconsin. Mayan Silver is a reporter for Milwaukee Public Radio. She covers the southeast of this state. With both candidates in Wisconsin today, does she think they're trying to win over undecided voters like Jackson or getting their supporters out to vote?
The campaigns are really trying to turn out their bases in key areas, but they're also trying to convince undecided voters like Jackson. Polls show that the number of undecided voters in Wisconsin is about 5%, but really here, every vote makes the difference, as you showed in that story. The Harris campaign has been targeting Republicans and moderates who may be skeptical of Trump. That's kind of been a strategy in swing states. They had an event in the Milwaukee suburbs with former Congresswoman Liz Cheney, a Republican who's endorsed Harris. And they're going after people like Jackson who are maybe persuadable on the issue of reproductive rights. The Trump campaign, on the other hand, has been saying that they're focusing on people who don't vote often, but who they think are likely to vote for him. They say these people are motivated by the economy and that their message to these people is vote for us if you feel you're worse off now than you were 4 years ago. That could also be Jackson, but really both campaigns are also just trying to turn out their bases.
Yeah, and briefly, Mayan, I mean, when Hillary Clinton lost this state to Donald Trump, she didn't visit Wisconsin at all, I think, during that 2016 campaign. How much attention has Wisconsin had from the candidates this year?
Wow, it's really night and day for the Democrats. Both sides have been crisscrossing the state. For Democrats, you know, Harris was here as her first stop after Biden stepped aside. They're going to be here this week, both candidates. We haven't had Beyonce or Taylor Swift yet, but Democrats are calling upon musicians to liven up college students, and Trump is pulling out the stops with celebrities like Green Bay Packers legend Brett Favre.
That was Mayan Silver, reporter for Milwaukee Public Radio.
Now, Jamie, in the last hour, we've seen Kamala Harris talking in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. We're expecting both Donald Trump and Kamala Harris to be in Wisconsin, where you are, in the next couple of hours. We've not heard so much from Joe Biden in this campaign, but he has been making the headlines in the last 24 hours with this.
And just the other day, a speaker at his rally called Puerto Rico a floating island of garbage. Well, let me tell you something. I don't know the Puerto Rican that I know, or Puerto Rico, where I'm in my home state of Delaware. They're good, decent, honorable people. The only garbage I see floating out there is his supporters. his demonization of Latinos is unconscionable.
Now, Jamie, it feels like the Harris campaigns had to do some unexpected clearing up after that and then trying to contain the damage.
Yes, I mean, the Trump campaign certainly pounced on that comment. They compared it to Hillary Clinton's infamous and pretty damaging description back in 2016 of some Trump supporters as a basket of deplorables. Now, the White House said that President Biden wasn't referring to supporters, plural, but to one supporter with an apostrophe S, namely that warm-up act at Saturday's Trump rally who joked about Puerto Rico being a floating island of garbage. But the controversy does allow the Trump campaign to get off the back foot on this issue, and it rather undercuts the message of unity that Kamala Harris has been trying to emphasize. She has had to come out and say she disagrees with any criticism of people based on how they vote.
When you start having to explain someone's punctuation, you know the message hasn't quite landed. You can hear more from our teams on the road in the US with a special episode of the NewsHour podcast that is out now. It's the first of two specials with James Menendez and guests in San Antonio, Texas. They're tackling the issue of immigration, which is right near the top of those confronting voters as they make their choice ahead of the vote next Tuesday. You can download it wherever you get your BBC podcasts or subscribe and sign up to the NewsHour feed. This is Andrew Peach in London. You're with NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Is this the greatest boxer of all time?
Listen, I'm going to float like a butterfly and sing like a bee. George can't hit what his eyes can't see. Now you see me, now you don't. You think you will, but I know you won't.
Now, part of the reason we think of Muhammad Ali as the greatest is a fight that happened 50 years ago today, the Rumble in the Jungle.
Champion of the world at 32 in the eighth round by a knockout.
The fight took place in the sweltering heat of Kinshasa, now in the Democratic Republic of Congo. I've been talking to the man who was there in the ring with Muhammad Ali, George Foreman. He was the overwhelming favourite to win the fight, but how did he feel going into it?
I had walked through the contendership and I'd beaten the best one in boxing, Joe Frazier. Then I backtracked and beat all the guys who had beaten Muhammad Ali. So all the reporters and the experts said, oh, he's not going to last one round with George Foreman. But of course, other things came to play, like that fast right hand from Muhammad Ali.
Did you go into it utterly confident, as all the journalists and fans were, that he had no chance against you?
I had always been real nervous, butterflies before boxing matches. But for the first time in my boxing career, I was in Africa, didn't have any butterflies, was not afraid, and it was probably the most comfortable I'd felt before a boxing match that night.
So when you heard Muhammad Ali talking the talk and saying he was going to beat you, you thought he'd got no chance?
He didn't say a word to me. His media... His talk was to the media that went across the world. So a lot of things went on, and I never heard him boast at all until seconds before the boxing match when we came to the center to be introduced by the referee.
And did you have any exchange of words at that point?
Yes, he looked at me and looked like he was trying to psych me out because I stared at him with a fierceness. He said, George, you don't have business in here with me. You were in high school when I won the championship of the world. And I almost burst out laughing because I never saw a day in high school in my life. Somebody told him wrong.
Once you're in the ring with him, did it feel like it started well from your point of view? Did it feel like it was going the way you expected?
Yeah, one punch led to another punch. I never had to defend myself in the ring.
And what was he saying to you during the fight? Because those of us who've seen it can see that he's talking to you. What was he saying, if you remember?
I remember one frightening moment, could have been about the sixth or seventh round. I hit him so hard, he said, "That all you got, George?" I remember that.
And how did you feel at that moment?
I wanted to tell him, yep, that's all I got. And of course I kept hitting him, but I'd run out of gas.
Tell me about the rope-a-dope thing, because no one had done that before. Could you work out what this strategy was that he was basically making up during the match?
Well, my thing was to corner a guy, cut the ring off, and then batter him up. And a couple of times he tried to move, and it wasn't there for him. I cornered him and just started hammering him. And it must have been about the third round. I wailed on him, and the bell rang, and he looked at me and looked as if to say, I made it. And I looked at him and said, he made it. That was a surprise and turning point in that fight. I don't know how he made it.
Tell me about the end of the fight.
Well, as swiftly, I kept following him around, trying to knock him out. He slipped, and when I missed him, he slipped and hit me with a 1-2, the most fast right hand I'd ever not seen, if you know what I mean. He hit me, and that right hand wasn't powerful. It wasn't anything but so fast. And there I was tumbling down like a tree and waiting for the ref to count. I jumped up. The fight was over. The man was fast. And I heard about his speed, and I kind of laugh about that. But he threw that right hand lightning fast.
It's 50 years ago today, George. How do you think about it now, reflecting on that moment, probably the greatest moment in Muhammad Ali's career? How does it feel to you to be retelling the story to me now?
You know, I'm glad because I was there that people can talk with me about it 50 years later, not hear a third-hand report. And I'm still alive to talk about it. It turned out to be the best thing that ever happened to me. I became an evangelist, preaching on the street corners, and nobody knew me. I'd cut my hair, had overalls on, and people wouldn't stop. And then one day I decided, yes, this is George Foreman. I fought Muhammad Ali, Joe Frazier, and people started to stop. Yeah, I was in that fight. The rumble in the jungle, they stopped again. If I didn't have that story behind me, I never would have been able to get my message over. It was no more than any other guy on the street corner saying, the world is coming to an end. I made another comeback in the fight years later, almost 20 years later. And people knew more about that rumble in the jungle than they did about me. You know, nobody want to lose, don't get me wrong. But in hindsight, it was a great thing that happened to me. And I'm happy about it now.
And let me ask you this, George. Do you think Muhammad Ali was the greatest boxer of all time?
Well, he was the greatest one in that beat me up at all time. I can only speak for myself. There were so many great fighters. And Muhammad had, when I fought him, he didn't hit the most hard. He didn't move the most fast. But you talk about a man who had the willingness to hang in there, I'd never seen anything like that. Because of his personality and because of how he behaved around me years later, I call him the greatest, but it had nothing to do with boxing.
And that was the boxer George Foreman reflecting on the rumble in the jungle with Muhammad Ali 50 years ago today. Loved talking to George. Online at bbc.com/news, all the build-up to the US election next week. The latest from today's rallies in North Carolina and Pennsylvania and soon in Wisconsin, where we've been. Also, a focus on why abortion looms so large in this US election campaign. bbc.com/news. From me, Andrew Peach, here in London and our team in Wisconsin, thank you for being with us for NewsHour here on the BBC World Service.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.